Making the way in the world today takes everything you got.
You know it's going to be a super fun interview when out of nowhere, your guest suddenly breaks out the theme song from Cheers. Welcome to today's episode of the Ashtanga Dispatch podcast with one of my favorite yoga teachers and Peloton instructor who promises to never give up his day job, Ross Rayburn. I'm Peg Mulqueen, your host. I loved Ross the moment I met him. He has this spark and enthusiasm that is just so contagious. Plus, Ross is truly one of those special, skilled teachers who makes every yoga experience an experience of you. Ross recently wrote a book called Turning Inward, which is not your typical book on meditation. In fact, he rarely even calls it meditation, preferring the word introverting, or like his title, the act of turning inward, which we all do and are drawn to do in our own way, even if we don't call it meditation. According to Ross, turning inward could be time spent in the garden, knitting, or even listening to this podcast. Whatever it is that you do that quiets the outside noise and brings you a sense of peace, this is what a contemplative practice is. This is something else I love about Ross, the way he presents philosophy and practice in ways that are inclusive, accessible, incredibly down to earth, and sometimes unconventional. Like when he explains another side of Narodha.
And you're like kicking ass down the rapids. That's a kind of Narodha because you're in the flow and you're navigating and you're experiencing a kind of cessation of the fluctuations because you're so in tune with the fluctuations.
Anyway, I think you're going to love this second conversation I had with Ross, even better than the first one that I forgot to hit record in. True story. Oh, well. Luckily, Ross also has a great sense of humor.
I love this meeting's being recorded from the beginning.
I'm such a dope.
Well, you know, what's in a good way. What's a good thing is I was thinking like, I can't even remember anything that I said, which means that, you know, it's going to be like the first time anyway.
Actually, it is much better because I am halfway, not all the way through your book.
Oh, that's great. That makes me so happy.
Oh, I am loving the book. So I've made notes. So I have a notebook that I've been like writing in because that's what I do when I, first of all, you are a word nerd. You are such a word. I think I needed another pad of paper for vocabulary.
Well, you know, what's funny is because I do love words so much. And strangely, it was the study of Sanskrit that really sparked more of my interest. You know, since it's higher up on the Indo-European chain, and I love patterns, and you know, when you start to see patterns in all these different languages and words, like it really gets the ball, like it's a snowball effect. And one of the things that Eve, my co-writer, you know, she's a ghostwriter, but I called her my co-writer. Well, you know, she often would have to say to me, like, it's a beautiful word, but we need to speak a little bit more. Not dumb it down, but speak in a more pedestrian, accessible way.
Well, this just goes to show you what a word nerd I am. When you were saying it was Sanskrit, I was thinking to myself, just last week I taught a lesson talking about primary series, like the different postures. Do you realize that the names for the postures at the primary level are very literal? You know, head to knee. It's like those sort of things, right? A bound angle. I mean, they're very triangle, very literal. Then they start moving to animals. So they get a little bit more subtle. Yeah. And then they start bringing in deities. So it's like these layers that happen as you progress. So not only do the postures become more complicated, but we start to like move into these subtler energies other than just the outer physical. Isn't that really cool?
Wait, did you discover that?
I think so. But I thought I discovered Narodha as a flow state. And then I read it in your book. So I was like, okay, well, that wasn't it.
Yeah, but listen, you know, I'm like you. I mean, obviously, I'm not as steeped in Ashtanga, particularly as an asana you know, limb or Ashtanga in terms of the asana practice as you are, but I certainly am aware of that world. And I've never heard of that before. And that is, that's so freaking cool.
Isn't that? And it's okay, this is how geeky I am. And it's Samapati, because Samapati is blending, right? The blending of our understanding with words and understanding and experience. So we start off in a very elementary, very physical, literal way. And then we start to do that blending where we're like infusing it with energy. And then like, ideals and qualities that are beyond just the physical. I just think it's really cool.
I love that. That's very cool.
Okay. Well, that's neither here. Well, it's actually a little bit of what you were talking about, because the book is called Turning Inward, and it was much different than I expected.
How so?
Okay. Well, I have to say, there was one quote that I wrote down that I really loved that spoke to me. Thinking you're doing it wrong is the quickest path to quitting.
For a lot of people. One of the main reasons why I wanted to write the book was because I had always assumed, and that there were a lot of people out there that were like me, that liked the idea of meditating and maybe even had sensed some benefit from it, but that for the most part were frustrated by it and had overlaid these someone else's expectations about what it was and were frustrated by it, or just simply didn't think that it was for them or couldn't do it. And that the B part of that is that that was really shown to me in vivid form when I started working on a platform where I wasn't going to yoga studios. I was on a fitness platform. For a lot of my students at Peloton, where meditation was the add-on. So I was really working with a lot of people like me, very type A, go, 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 who closed their eyes and their thoughts were noisy and painful and thought they would never be able to meditate or didn't even want to meditate. And so even though it's always been, because of my own experience, a desire to help people realize that it's possible, even if your thoughts go crazy when you close your eyes, and like I said, hated meditation, a book that basically spoke to me/us, but essentially, even it that expanded into the idea of like busting the whole paradigm, and like trying to get past even calling it meditation and calling it, anything.
You hardly use the word meditate. Yeah, I mean, you do, but you hardly do.
Yeah, and it was really, and the purpose is to the idea is that it really is so much more about the efficacy, the potential agency, the peace, the calm, the authenticity, the benefit. Like for me, that's so much more important as just the way that I walk through the world than necessarily, you know, the regalia of accomplishment.
One of the words you do use, which was a real switch and I enjoyed, was a different take on introversion and extroversion. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. The word, I actually heard the word first. Obviously, I knew the word introversion in terms of the characteristic of being an introvert and an extrovert. And it's funny, I always used to push back a little bit on the different definitions. Like, for instance, there's the definition of you're considered an introvert if you gain your power by being alone, or you're an extrovert if you gain your power by being outside. And I think that that's a pretty great definition, except for the fact that it's such a binary that it wasn't 100% true for me. Therefore, it makes me always think like those different patterns and like social categorizations are useful, but they can't be 100% accurate.
We took those words and used them as labels, but they weren't really supposed to. It was actually closer, I think, in its origination to the way you explain it. How weird is that?
That's very cool. I give Carlos Pomeda, who was, you know, in the Anusara yoga system, one of the great things that John Friend did was he put us in front of a lot of different philosophy teachers. Many of them were from the Siddha yoga tradition. And like Sally Kimpton, who was my primary teacher, Douglas Brooks, Carlos Pomeda, they were all part of that lineage, and they were either religious professors or they were former swamis. And Carlos was teaching one time. We were on the faculty at the Asia Yoga Conference in Hong Kong. And he was the first one, at least that I had heard, use the word introversion as a substitute for meditation. And for me, it just made sense to explain to people, especially now that social media and the fact that we're looking at and we're focused on things outside of ourselves for most of the day, that that kind of extroversion, meaning literally looking outside of ourselves, is the primary component or the prime, it takes up more time during our day. And then when you put that into the realm of homeostasis, which is something that I've found, I've always been looking for things in life that people don't, that people agree on. Like, people agree about gravity. You know, people agree about the sun rising and falling, you know, the sun coming up and going down. And most people agree that there is this thing in the universe called homeostasis relative to energy and biology and all sorts of things. And so even if you look at introversion, like looking in and looking out as an introvert, as what is homeostatic, not necessarily what is equal, but just the necessity of the human body and mind and spirit to find some homeostasis, it made a lot of sense to me to take this looking out that we do all day long and say to people, hey, what about finding ways in your day that you look in and recognizing those, not as necessarily better, but just as that kind of balancing homeostatic input that will probably yield the same kind of benefits that you get from going to bed. And don't even worry about if you call it meditation or not.
I found that so much more accessible. Like right before we just got on the phone, I thought to myself, I was out in my garden because it's now starting to get just slightly warmer. So I was out there and I thought, huh, I'm out here introverting. You know.
Absolutely. And to me, that's really what was so beautiful, is to widen the scope. Because let's be honest, there is something really sweet about when someone learns to meditate. And, you know, they whether egotistically or not, you know, they kind of tell people that they learn to meditate. And when you take away the sort of the snide part about, like, you know, the old joke about how do you know someone's vegan? Don't worry, they'll tell you. You know, it's kind of like that with meditation, but that comes from a sweet place of learning to meditate is a healthy, beautiful thing. And if you accomplish that, particularly by overcoming an inability to meditate, that is sort of something to be proud of. And so one of the things that I wanted to say in the book is, or at least to offer to people potentially, is you can have that same kind of pride of I'm doing something good for myself, but I'm doing it in the form of gardening. I'm doing it in the form of running. I'm doing it in the form even maybe of binging a Netflix show, as long as I do that with the intention of affirmation. And I'm having this glass of wine, not as pure avoidance of my reality, but maybe as a softening of my reality, so that after my glass of wine, I'm a nicer person and I won't yell at my kids. Like, anything that is that kind of, that ameliorates the shadow, such that we can integrate the shadow into the light, like, that to me is much more interesting than any kind of perfect ecstatic somatic, you know, like samadhi like experience that are beautiful to have in lotus position. I'm all for it when that happens, but to have something where someone, like you just said, like, has a moment of turning in and it just warms your heart a little bit, that to me was a much more interesting topic.
Well, it's also pretty accessible. I definitely had a hard time. I thought that you were supposed to stop thinking, and I wasn't stopping thinking. And then I would just beat myself up. So I basically sit and be like, okay, I'm sitting. I'm here. Shit, what was that? And I'd be like, oh man, I just did it wrong. And I was always going, oh, I did it wrong. And so I was beating myself up. But I've seen students actually get anxious, like an anxiety level, because we've put so many rules around meditation. Do you know what I mean? Like so many things we think we have to do.
We've talked before about Nirodha. Like remind me what your, because I know you have a different definition of Nirodha than a lot of people, or like of explain, if you want to just give the Yogacitta, the whole sutra.
I always think of it like a flow state. And so instead of, so when we're stilling, it's not really stilling, it's going with the flow, it's navigating, it's not resisting or willing, it's simply being with what is. And so I think of that very much like a flow state, because it's such a full presence, and it can happen in a really good way, lovely, like in things that we thoroughly enjoy and are into, but it also can happen in everyday life when you hit up with an obstacle and you work with it and integrate rather than try to avoid or fight it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love that. So when I first started studying Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, it's been a long time, but it is the second sutra, right? Yogacitta Vritti Nirodha is the second, right? It's often translated, at least for me, it was translated as, you know, citta is consciousness, vrittis are the movements of consciousness or the fluctuations of the mind, and Nirodha is the cessation.
Yes.
Of those fluctuations. And in a certain, like, I always try to give value to the original system, like the denotation, meaning the original meaning, versus the connotation, which is the interpretation that we have now. The denotation original meaning made a lot of sense in a world, you know, in a arguably less nuanced world where things were a little bit more stop and start. Like even if you just take in terms of the deities, if you have, you know, a dualistic situation where you basically have Brahma and human, it oftentimes those traditions lean toward absolute terms. And so when I first heard Nirodha as, well, what really made sense for me, like the first time I envisioned vrittis, not as these kind of painful fluctuations, meaning like out of control, dangerous fluctuations, but rather vrittis as the currents of the rapid river flowing downstream. And like the currents and the rapids, those are definitely movements. Those are definitely fluctuations that are seemingly random. And if you're caught in them without some sort of navigable vehicle, you know, you're screwed. You're going to be taken under. So the way to get out of the fluctuations of the rapids is you find your way into the place where they have seceded, which is on the shore. And so the Nirodha out of the rapids would be to go over the shore and sit quietly so that you're not in the tumult of the waves. Where there's another way that you can navigate the flow of the river, which is with a lot of experience and skill, in a really great raft with a community of really great rafters, and you're like kicking ass down the rapids, that's a kind of Nirodha, because you're in the flow and you're navigating and you're experiencing a kind of cessation of the fluctuations because you're so in tune with the fluctuations. And so you have these feelings of apparent stillness even though you're flying down the river. And so the argument then would be, is there a palpable or is there some kind of difference that's worth it being notable between peace from sitting still and peace from the apparent stillness of convergence with the flow? And that is a much more interesting question to me, rather than you must sit on the shore or you must do this. I wanted to say something like, look, forget about what you should do. Instead, look for that moment of peace, that moment of flow, that moment of freedom, that moment of kindness, that moment of being able to take a deep breath when you lose someone you love. Like even in the darkest moment, to still somehow be enveloped in the light. Like that to me is evidence of the cessation of the fluctuations. Thus is yoga, is meditation. And that's really hard to get around when people are just told, you've got to stop your thoughts.
Well, it goes back to what we started talking about is the very literal interpretations. I mean, the sutras were just, they were seeds. Things were supposed to grow from them, not just, you know, a seed and this is it, it stops here. And yeah. When you used the river, that really speaks to me. I live on the river. Do you know that? I live on the river.
Yeah, of course. I know my audience.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. It's very true. Yes. And you're saying it and I'm like, yeah, the river, because on a river, it's not like an ocean. An ocean, you can float around and you don't have to really pay attention. You're navigating a river. You have to be so present. You have to really be aware of your surroundings. You have to be in it. You are in it. But also there's slow water and you can, you know, you can move off into the slow water. You can go yeah. through the rapids and you can, you know, look ahead. And it is all about really being in that raft and with it. And that, I understand that. And it's not always peace. Does it always have to be peaceful? Is it like...
No, not at all. I think oftentimes, like I joke about, you know, because the subtitle of the book is Calm, Joyful, Authentic Life. And like for me, calm is an extremely relative term that I think I've probably said this to you before. You know, my friends joke with me, like, I can't believe you teach meditation. I'm like, actually, no, this is me on meditation. I would have no friends at all if I didn't like sit and turn in. It can be peace. It can be all sorts of things, but something I've tried to say over and over in the book is, even though it's important to note the affirmation or the moments where you feel better than you feel worse, but it's also important to note that even if you do feel worse, even if you don't feel peace, that you're planting seeds and you're putting your attention toward your own health and the health of your community and your family just by turning in, even if it doesn't give you the result that you didn't expect it to. And so it's sort of this, it's a little bit of a nuanced conversation of like all of these things. Yes, it might give you peace and it might give you joy, but I'm such a huge Joseph Campbell fan, and one of my favorite Joseph Campbell isms is, and this is paraphrasing him, he said it's that the shortest way or the quickest way to rob yourself of revelation is to name it or even expect it before you experienced it. And that is the trap. That is the ultimate trap of having an agenda or a reason to turn in or to meditate, because we're human and we are going to name it before we experience. We are going to set goals. We need to set goals. But if we can cultivate this ability to sort of say, yes, I'm going to sit down because I want to find a little bit more peace. I want to find a little bit more calm, but then go into a nebulous space and not name it, not expect it. In fact, be so willing for it not to be there that you're even excited when it's not. That's, I think, what Joseph Campbell was referring to as the gateway to the true bounty of experiencing things that you really didn't expect. That's really when the doors are flung open to creativity and wisdom, because you are so open that you've chosen not only to not name, but not even to expect. What you're looking for.
It's like a porous mind. You know, when
yeah.
you said in your book that it's not a panacea. And I appreciated that because I think sometimes we go into any sort of contemplative or mindfulness practice and we think it's going to solve everything. And actually sometimes it's really hard to be present. I mean, you know, like.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, and I tried to write that often in the book because it's, finally putting it down on paper really it really became evident of how easy it is to write something down as a solution or as an aid in service in trying to help people. And for that being perceived, it's sort of like the way, you know, the Bible works. You know, once it's written down, it becomes text. It becomes so concretized that it goes into that binary part of our brain of right and wrong. Well, Ross said it, it must be good. Therefore, if it's not good, it's either wrong or wrong for me. And so that kind of trying to, by saying it's not a panacea, was my way of reminding people that turning inward is about turning away from the binary right and wrong part of our consciousness and turning into the unitary, nebulous, indescribable field of wisdom and creativity that where that fixing is no longer an issue. Like we've actually, the idea of what hopefully what it means is by saying it's not a panacea, there's nothing wrong. Therefore, you don't need a panacea. Now, hopefully it does help. And hopefully it does make people feel better and it does work over time. And especially over time, you become a different person because of that. I certainly believe that. But from the short version of A, it's not going to fix it, even if it's really good. It might make it a little bit better. It's not a panacea in that way. And B, the more sophisticated version is, don't think of it as a panacea, because that's staying in the mind of there is something inherently wrong that needs to be fixed. Think about it as going in and shifting perspective, hearing a different voice, opening up to a different connection and relationship with yourself or with someone else, and create an environment that a new iteration arises. So whether it's a fix, a panacea or not, it becomes moot. You're creating an environment to become the next version of you, and fixing is no longer the issue.
I found that when, as over the years, what I've learned to do is soften my mind a little. I explained this to you earlier about, you know, how they always say meditation is like walking the dog, you know, on a lead. And I would like choke my dog, you know, I'd be sitting there. And I'm an intense person anyway. So I would sit with all my intensity and my laser focus. And, you know, it was so tight and so hard. And not only was it tight grip on what I thought it should be, but also a tight grip on what I thought I should be. And I've learned over the years what's helped the most, and I heard you say this all through your book in so many different ways, is softening those ideas. And you talked about the expansion, the widening of the mind. And the more I soften, the easier it becomes. The bigger my definitions and the wider the experiences I allow myself to, the easier it becomes. And I really appreciate you made that point in so many different ways. And I wrote down in my notes, inclusion is important to you. It clearly was a value of yours. Yes?
Absolutely. I mean, one of my highest values, one of my highest goals is in fact, in writing the book, I really, even just in a political way, I wanted to really make sure, because I'm very progressive and, you know, but I wanted to make sure that I wrote this book that would resonate with like pan demographically, pan ideologically, pan generationally, really from the very simple idea that everybody can turn in. My editor would get very frustrated with me. She's like, who's your audience? I'm like, well, everybody, because everybody can turn in. And even just to be inclusive of the softening, just to even sort of practice what I preach, the softening makes sense for me too. And you and I are very similar. And I think there are a lot of people like us that living in the world I met the woman who wrote the theme song of Cheers last night.
No way.
I did. And I found out after she walked away from the table. So now in my head, all I can think of is making the way in the world today takes everything you got. So I was like, why is that in my head right now? But making the way in the world today, most of us, I think, do have a natural edge, protection, hardness. I mean, you could even say arguably since we were, you know, since humans began, there is, of course, a natural, and in the animal kingdom, there is a natural fight or flight protective mechanism. And so the hardening, the softening of that hard shell probably makes sense to a lot of people. And of course, it makes sense in this realm of if we're talking about going into, as we've already discussed, a nebulous, open, very vulnerable place of potentiality, getting past the hard shell, whether it be fluctuations of the mind, whether it be some scars, you know, old stuff, softening those, you know, softening the pull of the leash, that does make sense. But just to be really super inclusive, I want to also say there might be someone out there that's too soft. You know, that may not apply to everybody. If someone is so, you know, I mean, there's like, did you the story in the book about the three brothers on the road about the water? You know, there are people that get stuck often even in the spiritual realm. And they can essentially become so soft in their heart that then when they need to be hard, they don't access it quick enough and they get hurt. Now, hopefully not hurt so much that they can't recover from that and learn from that. But I've definitely, I mean, you and I know people in common who are so open that when they get traumatized, it's like some major trauma. And so even though, yes, I am with you on the softening is the way what I need to do to get in, I also want to make a point that back to the homeostasis idea is that if you need to create a shell, if you need to harden such that you feel safe to go inside, that's what that person needs to do.
That was another part of my notes. You talked about a healthy skepticism, which is not something you expect to hear. I agree. Can you explain that?
Yeah. I mean, basically, look, it's like, I mean, part of it is like, can I cuss on your podcast?
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much bullshit, you know? It's like, even, first of all, there's a lot of bullshit from people who don't know what they're talking about, who are trying to be authorities. And so they say things that they don't really know, and there's that kind of bullshit. And then there's like less, you know, better meaning bullshit, meaning saying things that they've, you know, kind of resonated with them, but they're really, you know, generalizing. Maybe they haven't learned it enough to translate it into other people's experience. And so they say it, and, you know, like one of my favorite stories is the husband and the wife, they're cooking ham. And the I always like to say, you know, like make it a modern family, and the husband's cooking the ham dinner, and he cuts off the ends of the ham, and his wife said, "Honey, why do you always cut off the ends of the ham?" And he's like, "I don't know," like calls his mom, and, "Hey mom, why don't we always cut off the ends of the ham?" And she's like, "I don't know, honey, call your grandma." So he calls his grandma and like, "Grandma, why do we always cut off the ends of the ham?" And his grandma says, "Well, darling, the pan was too small." And I think there are so many things that we tell people that, back to the connotation denotation, especially like in religious and spiritual circles, metaphors that were used long ago that no longer apply. And so it isn't necessarily bullshit, but it might, some things have lost their meaning. And so the reason why that I wrote the healthy skepticism part is because that is such a real thing in our world today. And it's so easy because it's so, because there is so much bullshit and so much misunderstanding and miscommunication in our world today that oftentimes people go past skepticism directly to cynicism. That if we consciously choose a healthy skepticism all the time, it lessens the chance that we're going to fall into a cult-like mentality and believe everything, which I've done before, or fall into a cynical perspective, which I've also done. And instead, which would be making this a kind of an argument for the most present-minded part of this particular triad, a moment to moment, day by day, case by case, healthy skepticism.
I thought it was really relevant in yoga. I mean, especially in today's times, because, the skepticism, we could just rename that as discernment, you know, being discerning, right? But there's something in yoga, and I would say in spiritual communities where this questioning isn't encouraged. And so questioning isn't encouraged, but also B, we as a people seem to want to have like perfect teachers, perfect spiritual teachings. It's this need to maybe be right or be in the right. And so we kind of stop, we throw out that skepticism because it's almost as if you find anything, any fault or any deviance, then you have to, then it's all bad.
Just to put it in the frame of the book, the turning in part of it, the introversion part of it is discernment, the cultivating your skill to be present of mind enough to discern value, turning in also and remembering and seeing the value in the different experiences that you will have. Like for instance, seeing if you're in a place in your life when, even though you're going to have a you're going to suspend your skepticism maybe for a while because you are in a place where you just need to be, you know, in a childlike state and follow. And so therefore maybe you're tired and healthy skepticism isn't right for that day. And you just want to listen to a story. Or you suspend your healthy skepticism because you realize that I've been in a situation recently where I did question the authority and it turned out not going well because I didn't discern well enough to know that this was not someone that even though they said they were willing to have questions that they weren't really. And so there's also that awareness within that just because you have a healthy skepticism, are you also judicious enough to apply it in, and this is sort of the extroverted way, to apply it or not? And so for me, it's like, yes, know what it is, but also know the value of applying it or not applying it, or using it and not using it. That's what I like about discretion, why discretion is such a better word, because skepticism is really just of the mind. Discretion actually speaks to what you're receiving and also how you're acting on it. And that absolutely, I think that's something that we can only just, I mean, whether or not that's done a lot in different yoga schools, I agree with you. And I don't ever like to say like it is done or it's not. Like, I just don't know enough about the yoga community anymore to know how prevalent or not it is. The only thing I can speak to is that I try to cultivate a healthy skepticism and I try to cultivate my capacity to see the value in applying it or not applying it.
I agree with that as well. Yeah. I can think back very personally, though, that there were times, and I like the turning inward because this is a process, right? This turning inward and getting under those layers. And there were years where I didn't question because I didn't want to be rejected. I didn't want to be kicked out. I wanted to be part of it, and you have to buy it all. We can talk about this in in religious institutions, in various, you know, communities, spiritual or not, I'm sure. We could talk about it politically, but there is, I feel like, an epidemic right now of like-minded thinking and this and the questioning. I mean, just because the person didn't receive your questioning well, I don't think it, I personally think it's good that you do anyway. And it's not to the point. I actually think it's, you said this actually in your book, and that it's not about answers. It is about questions. And I just love that. But I had to really go deep within me and find out why was I not willing to question? Why was I allowing this dissonance, a word you use a lot, the dissonance, why was I willing to not address it, like ignore it, and really get deep and really realize that it was because I was afraid of losing my place, afraid of not being a part, and really coming in touch with that insecurity. And I think that's what I was talking about when I said, it's not always pleasant, that turning inward, you know, that shadow work, that looking in and really, but the only way to kind of get through it is to be with it and to at least give, and sometimes here, giving it a name, you know, and actually labeling it takes some of its power away. I think that helped me.
Yeah, I love that. First of all, I 100% agree with that. This is essentially a restatement of what you said, but there is no doubt, this is nothing kind of revelatory to say that speaking truth to power, not saying something out of fear because you don't want to be shunned, you know, you're the new person in the office and you don't want to speak up because if you say something wrong, you won't ever get called on again. There's a great book called Creativity Inc. that was written by Ed Catmull. It's about that he started Pixar, and the paradigm in his conference room was like everyone had to speak. He tried to cultivate an environment of zero fear, maximal creativity. So on one level, it's sort of acknowledging that speaking truth to power, the fear of bridging or accepting power dynamics is a thing. And then associated with that is sort of the self, the individual version of depending upon our place in that power structure, we all fall into those same patterns. We fall in when in a powerful position, we fall in unconsciously, probably into the pattern of suppressing opinions. And when we're in the less powerful position, we've definitely probably not spoken about a fear. So I set both of those things aside, or at least I try to in the book, and really sit and really focus more on the practice of awareness. Are you simply aware? Can you take a deep breath in the moment of a power dynamic, potential speaking truth to power moment? Can you take a deep breath in and realize to the best of your ability what's going on? What you're experiencing in that moment, your instinct versus your rationality versus the pragmatic versus the super courageous swing for the fences. And then turning in first to identify what your reality in that moment is, and then turning into an even deeper layer and judiciously making a choice based on that reality. And that, again, is case by case, moment by moment. And I would argue that maybe you aren't always going to make the right choice. Maybe you won't speak truth to power, even when you probably should. But at least you recognized it. And that, to me, is a much more sure path toward choosing a life of less regret.
It really is that simple, isn't it, Ross? It's just really taking a few breaths. No, seriously, like what you're saying, just taking a few breaths, like really actually just slowing down and taking a moment.
If only remembering to take a deep breath were simple, then it would be simple.
but if we can, you're right. The world doesn't really promote this kind of slowing or pausing.
I'm really not just being funny or argumentative. I say this from experience. Like, I wrote a freaking book about this, and I can give you three examples this week where I did not stop and take a deep breath before I reacted. So that to me is proof. I am like, if you define an expert by somebody who's written a book, I am an expert on this subject who just failed my own test three times this week. So therefore, be very loving and patient and forgiving with yourself on this path.
Well, I will say also, where do you live?
New York.
Yes. And I live in Montana. And I think it's so funny because, wow, I got so much better at slowing down and pausing and being contemplative when I moved out of DC. And I recognize, I think to myself, I probably worked harder at it in DC and failed more at it in DC. So I always like remind myself of that I live in a place that's conducive now to that kind of turning inward. I mean, when you're talking about extroversion and introversion, I'm like, you ask, think about the people that you saw today. And I'm like, no one. Think about the last interaction you had. Haven't. I was thinking to myself, but it is true that where you live, like taking the context of our lives, and there are times in my life when my kids were little, where my life was really busy, and really just taking a few breaths or journaling in the morning, that was the most I could do. And that was a lot.
I love that. That's so beautiful. And I think there's a lot of truth and important. It's probably a part of the book that I didn't, like, if I were to expand on it or whatever, I think that would be an interesting element to expand on, like really the differences in environments and how that affects this topic. Tell me or not if you agree with this, that there's parts of it that apply, you know, the different separations, whether they be separations between people, separations between communities, separations between the facets of ourselves, like those parts are going to apply no matter how much, you know, physical interaction you have with people. Like, you're still having a relationship with the different parts of yourself, and you're still having a relationship with your past and your future and your present. And so in that sense, you know, where I totally agree with you, outer environment will affect your turning inward is still going to be your turning inward, because you only have you to turn into, and you're never going to turn into nothing. You're always going to turn into something, and you're always going to turn into some set of relationships. Therefore, all of the different ideas about bridging the gaps and the chasms and the relationships of what you find within will apply to everybody.
I love this. I wish we could talk more often. I wish we didn't live so far apart.
We can talk anytime you want. I'm around.
This has been so good. Thank you so much.
I miss you. I mean, I do. I would love to see you in person and like actually give you a squeeze, because
I do
one of our famous heart-shaped handstands again.
Oh, I should post that one.
I love one of my favorite pictures.
Oh, thank you, Ross. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Meg, so much. Give your family a big giant hug and hello for me.
You send your husband my love as well.
I will. Yeah, definitely come to New York, come visit.
Why don't you both come to Montana? Hello.
Well, listen, he's the one that's tough now. He's just going gangbusters. His schedule, he's doing well. It's a problem of abundance, but he's the tricky one. I could probably slide out there and come say hi. So maybe let's make that happen.
Please do. Please do. Cool. I would love to have you, both of you, whenever. Just come. It would be such a joy. I would love that.
Awesome. Much love.
Love you.
See ya.
You can find Ross's book, Turning Inward, on Spotify or order through Amazon. And if you're interested in more down-to-earth practical study of yoga philosophy, then I encourage you to join our online courses.
visit ashtangadispatch.com and click on the path to learn more, or join our monthly email. As always, thanks so much for listening and making your way through the world with us.